I've been accused of misconduct for not hurting patients. Not for negligence, but for saying things the government didn't like. Now, they were the words of Dr. Marcus de Bruin at a protest last week in Dublin. He accused the government, by the way, also of wasting $50 billion on COVID, on vaccines that had to be returned, on contracts for the boys, empty hospitals, and payments to GPs, probably including himself. I'll get to the bottom of that in a second. He also posted yesterday on X, to the colleagues who told me quietly that I was right, but said nothing publicly, I understood it then, obviously talking about COVID, but silence has a cost, and I'm paying it now. My DMs are open, or you know how to reach me by email. If you ever meant it, now it's time. In other words, come forward. I'm not going to disagree with that, and I'll tell you why in a second. Now, I spoke to Dr. Marcus de Bruin, possibly before anybody else did, when he handed in his resignation in the medical council. And at that time, the reason why that was, because he was essentially blowing the whistle on the wrongdoings of the state by moving patients, elderly patients, from hospitals back into nursing homes, essentially a death sentence. Because at that time, COVID-19 was spreading through nursing homes, through the vulnerable, obviously, more so than anywhere else in the general population. And Marcus, obviously being a caring person and a doctor, believed this was the wrong thing to do. Now, since the COVID hysteria ended, Marcus kind of opted for a few years of stepping out of the limelight publicly. But now he's fighting for his medical license. He's fighting for his job, his career, his ability to put food on the table, which he believes the medical council will take away from him in June in what they call a fitness hearing. Marcus de Bruin joins me for this interview today. Hi, Marcus. How are you? Oh, sorry, Marcus. I need to hire you up.
Say I'm great, but I'm not doing too bad, I suppose. Given the circumstances, it's a beautiful day, and we're in the middle of spring. So, there's lots to be positive about. But as you mentioned there in your introduction, I have to appear before the medical council. As the result of an investigation that just finished about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and incidentally, I suppose coincidentally, the investigation began shortly after I spoke to you on your show with Pierce Doherty and I. We were both talking about the nursing homes, and Pierce Doherty at the time was promising a COVID investigation, and he was very disgusted about all the deaths in the nursing homes. But anyway, that hasn't happened.
No, we're still waiting. At that time, in fairness, we kind of sprung that on Pierce Doherty at the time because he wasn't aware that I was I brought you on just after I'd been talking to him about something else COVID related, and then we brought you on obviously because you had resigned from the medical council because of this. I suppose at the time, Marcus, if we could take us back to COVID a little bit, you probably found it difficult to get on radio. There were very few radio presenters or radio shows that were willing to go against the government or even criticize what the government were doing.
Yeah, well, there was essentially a media blackout. I mean, I couldn't understand. I mean, just to correct you there, when you were mentioning in your introduction that the state transferred elderly patients from the hospital, that's not quite correct. What actually happened was Varadkar was talking about a second wave was going to come. So they cleared the hospitals of respite patients. So young, healthy people with broken arms or who were just on the last couple of days waiting to go home. So they essentially took those patients, healthy, relatively healthy, recovering patients, and transferred them into the nursing homes. Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose, you know, at the time I was in complete shock at what was going on, because they transferred these patients. I mean, I came into work one Monday morning only to be told by the nursing staff that there's 8 or 10 patients from Beaumont are now in the nursing home. And when I said, well, what's their COVID status? I was told, well, we don't know. So when I rang the hospital, they said, well, we haven't tested them. Test them yourself. Now, the difficulty with that was that at the time, the government had pulled the testing from the nursing homes for the whole country. If you had a positive patient, you were told there was going to be no more tests available for anyone else at the home. Just treat them all as if they have COVID. Now, the issue there was the only way of treating elderly patients that we had, or the only thing that we had to work with in the nursing homes, was the test. Because essentially we test the elderly patients and residents, and if one was positive, we'd be able to isolate them in their room and try and contain things. So all we had was the test. So if you try to kind of think of a way to actually conduct a manslaughter of people in the nursing homes by transferring patients from the hospital where COVID was rampant, dumping them into the nursing homes without contacting
where there
the
was
GP
vulnerable people, yeah.
Anybody,
yeah,
and without even testing them. And then on top of that, withdraw the testing because Varadkar and Neffert were saying there's a second wave coming. We mightn't have tests for the general public, so there'll be no testing done in the nursing home. So to me, this was, I mean, there's no other way to describe
it. I felt at the time, you know, I remember the conversation we had, and I remember, you know, the fact that we had Piers Doherty on from Sinn Féin at the time as well. And I felt at the time it was a kind of whistleblowing moment, but nothing ever happened. Now, I subsequently interviewed you a couple of times after that and other people too. By the way, I got accused only recently of being on the wrong side of history when it came to COVID. And I can honestly put my hand on my heart and say I did the best I could under the circumstances of the Broadcasting Authority that I did allow people to come on and challenge the state. So much so, by the way, that I was named in a Kinsen report, which the state paid 120 grand a month or something ridiculous for Stephen Donnelly. And I was named in it as being an anti-government and anti-lockdown broadcaster. So that was a quite proud badge that I hold now, by the way, can I just say?
Well, I suppose, you know, when I'll have to appear for the things that I said on your show, for the things that, I mean, subsequently when, you know, I mean, one of the other
What did you say on the show? Sorry for interrupting. What was it you said on my radio show that came up in that investigation? Like, what were some of the things that you said?
Well, essentially, any criticism of public health. Shortly after I was on your show, there was a memorandum issued to every GP in the country that said that we were duty bound. Doctors are duty bound to follow and promote public health guidelines. And this is the first time in the history. I was on the Medical Council for many years, and there's no mention anywhere that doctors are duty bound to promote. Now, certainly follow policies, which I did at my practice. We wore masks and we social distanced, and we certainly, I'm not before the council for any issue in terms of not following the guidelines. But in failing to promote the guidelines, and this was a new word that the president of the medical council then basically inserted or passed around to every GP in Ireland. So it became policy at the time that obviously.
And could you question that? Were you allowed to question that? Are doctors allowed to question policy?
Well, no. I mean, if it's a case that you're not promoting, that you're criticizing the policies, then obviously you're failing to promote the policy. So that was the memorandum that was sent around to every GP in the country. So shortly after your show, a couple of months after your show, I mean, I attended a protest in Dublin to try and highlight what was going on in the nursing homes or what had happened. I mean, the deaths had kind of had multiplied and were multiplying in the nursing homes. I attended a public rally.
And that was the one I mentioned earlier on, not the one last week. That was the one I had mentioned earlier on. Yeah.
Yeah. Shortly after that, in 2020, the medical council then issued proceedings against me. You know, now, I mean, just to back up, I suppose one of the reasons that are one of the things that I was finding most strange that was going on at the time was, for example, you take something. I mean, there was absolutely, when I said at the beginning there that the only thing we had to treat elderly people was isolating them in the room. The guidelines at the time, they wouldn't let us use things like hydroxychloroquine or any kind of medicine off license to try anything at all. And I was flabbergasted with this. Now, it's not, I mean, I'm not a big fan of hydroxychloroquine. I don't know if it works or if it didn't work. But I was really, really curious to know is why the medical council was stepping in and stopping doctors from using it.
Now, in relation to that, I mean, there was an argument at the time that the reason they didn't want you using it was because it was cheaper. And they obviously that was one of the conspiracies out there because it was cheaper. And of course, you know, the pharmaceutical companies wouldn't want you using something that's off license and lost its patent years ago and is 50 pence a box or something like that. But in saying that, I mean, to test that out, when I say to test it out, to try that on somebody who may have the symptoms of COVID-19 or indeed anything like that.
Yeah.
I mean, would it do them any harm?
Absolutely, utterly harmless. Hydroxychloroquine is an over-the-counter medication in many countries. It's a commonly used drug we use for...
So what was the problem then in just trying it?
These were the things that I couldn't understand. Why are patients being transferred into the nursing homes and doctors not being told with no testing status? Why are they pulling the tests? And why aren't they even allowing us to try medications that might, I mean, you remember Donald Trump came out and took it and it was highly politicized. But I was very curious as to why the medical council were policing this. Because if you go to the doctor, for example, and you've got the flu, you'll often be given an antibiotic. Now, antibiotics don't treat the flu. And what that's called is off-license. The doctor will say to you, well, look, you know, you've got the flu. If it's getting worse, there's an antibiotic there for you. You know,
yeah, just in case you get a chest infection. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, we often treat migraines with blood pressure tablets. This is called off-license use. It's hugely, hugely common. So something strange was happening during COVID. Here comes this drug that may have some benefit. We have absolutely no treatment, nothing. The guidelines from the College of Irish General Practitioners, the guidelines for the Medical Council are do not treat. And I found this absolutely bizarre. People are dying. What the hell is going on here? Mm. And it dawned on me, and it dawned on a number of colleagues, that what they were doing essentially was they were policing for the pharmaceutical companies. The vaccine was given authorization under EUA, Emergency Use Authorization. And one of the conditions of EUA is that there can't be any other emergency use authorization, is that there can't be any other medications available to treat the condition. So this is why the Medical Council, which has absolutely nothing to do with off-license prescribing or that, the Medical Council starts to get involved and policing doctors. So I started to scratch my head and say, what is going on here? This is totally strange, totally bizarre stuff. And once you start mentioning these connections or you scratch the surface, it soon becomes apparent that the relationship between the Medical Council is supposed to be an independent organization, but it actually works and is answerable to the minister. So the minister was not happy that there were a couple of GPs complaining about things. So one GP, Jerry Waters, he refused to give the vaccine when it came out because he wasn't happy with its contents, and he was struck off. You know, he was suspended, so he couldn't practice. They took his.
I mean, I talked about that on the radio at the time. I remember the story with Jerry Waters, and I talked about what they call conscientious objection. In other words, that if you as a doctor believe something wasn't good for your patients, be you right or wrong, that you can conscientiously object. And of course, that wasn't allowed because we were in an emergency, as they said, and him, like others too, you know, obviously got into trouble for doing that. But getting back to you, in relation to the vaccine, I mean, you were quite happy at the time to use the vaccine on adults when it came out first, even though you were probably sceptical in some way. But where you drew the line was when they started recommending it for children, because you didn't believe it was necessary.
Yeah, well, that was the main problem I had with the COVID vaccine, was that certainly, look, this is a risky experimental type of vaccine. It's never been used before. Everybody's
was it actually a vaccine? By the way, here's a question I've asked a couple of people. Nobody really can answer. By definition, was it a vaccine?
No, it wasn't.
Under the definition of what a vaccine actually is, it wasn't really a vaccine.
It's absolutely.
It's a spike protein.
No, it's completely, it's not even a spike protein. What it is a piece of genetics called messenger RNA. So a gene that's wrapped in a plasma membrane, and that's called a nanoparticle. And the gene, the little plasmid membrane, binds to your cells. The gene enters your cells and hijacks the production mechanisms inside your cell to make spike protein. So spike protein then is made by your cells, is expressed on the surface of your cells, or the cells burst and release the spike protein into your body. But you're not getting spike protein. You're getting the gene for spike protein. Mm. So the difficulty I had, and the difficulty very many colleagues had, was, hold on a second, you've crossed the Rubicon. This is completely, every other vaccine is that's available.
Yeah, because I want to state for the record, you're not anti-vax, because over your lifetime, you've obviously given the MMR vaccine to lots of kids.
According to the Medical Council, I am, because criticizing the vaccine is part of the reason that I have to face them in June, you know. So, but this is it's a completely different vaccine. So, look, I mean, I was at the cold face where my elderly residents in the nursing home, and 12 of them died in a period of like 8 weeks, you know. So I was of the belief, and still am, certainly that if you want to give something like that, you know, certainly to very, very high risk, vulnerable people, there is an argument. But for everybody else, for young, healthy people, and particularly for pregnant women and for young children, to give an injection that's getting inside their cells and operating at the level of their genetics, that's a completely different...
When there was very little risk for them in the first place.
Yeah,
in other words, I mean, I don't think there was one during that period of time of 2 years. I think there was one child that died. I think it was like 15 or 18 years of age. And they had multiple comorbidities as well. So it wasn't just, obviously, it was the usual, the line died not with or from COVID-19, but with COVID-19. So the idea that you would want to vaccinate children against something that seemed not to be too dangerous for children, just like every other, you know, children get coughs and colds and EBV and all sorts of things constantly all the time, and they overcome them very, very quickly because that's how they build up their own immune system. So the idea that we would want to vaccinate. And you know what blew my mind? I was on the radio one day and the news was on before me. And they said the government have now given, you know, the go ahead to vaccinate babies. And I'm going, what?
Yeah. Oh, Lord.
Why? No baby has died from COVID-19. No. Why are we vaccinating babies?
No.
It just didn't make sense to me at all.
No, by 2020, when I made that, went to the protest in 2020, at that time, there had been 70,000 positive cases for the age group 1 to 24. Or it might have been 1 to 16. So essentially newborns to young adults. And there hadn't been one single fatality out of 70,000 cases. So the notion of, look, I mean, whatever one thinks about the vaccine, certainly given it to pregnant women and children. So, but the thing was, I mean, the medical council wrote to me and they said, basically, if you don't give that vaccine, we'll suspend you. You're going to get the same as Jerry Waters. They call it a Section 52, which is an immediate strike-off. So my back was against the wall. I had no choice. I had to make a very, very difficult decision.
Because you have a wife and family and a career. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the decision that I made, and it's one that I, you know, that I still struggle with today, was that I closed my practice, you know, and when I closed my practice, I no longer had a cohort of patients that that needed to be vaccinated.
So you didn't have the obligation to give it. Yeah. In the first place.
I thought I was off the hook, and I thought that I could at least try and expose what was going on with the medical council. I mean, why was the medical council behaving like this? The job of the medical council, you'll see on its front page of its website, is to protect patients, protect the health and safety of patients. That's the job of the medical council. So, you know, and the funny thing is, well, not it's not funny, but the reality is that the medical council needs a complaint in order to initiate an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So the complaint that they used to initiate investigating me was when I went to that rally or that public demonstration in 2020, the medical council informed me afterwards that somebody wrote a complaint, apparently, saying that I didn't use hand sanitizer after I shook people's hands after the presentation. And therefore, the medical council were putting me under an investigation that's only concluded about 2 weeks ago. So that investigation went.
Why is it taking so long? It's been like 5 years now. Why is it taking so long to get to this point?
Because the purpose of the investigation is not to find out whether or not I used hand sanitizer. The purpose of the investigation is to have doctors like me, and there are many of us, there's about 12 doctors in Ireland, GPs at least. Now, there may be other specialties I don't know of. It's very hard to get any information from the medical council. But the purpose of the investigation is to put you under investigation, because once you're under investigation, if you fail to cooperate with the conditions of the investigation, that's grounds for immediate suspension. So once they have you under, so they've kept me under investigation for the past 5 years, they've collected all of my, anything I've put up on Twitter, and I write for a lefty magazine online called Cassandra Voices, a socialist magazine, and I've put articles in there why people don't need the vaccine and why I don't believe it's safe and that. So they've collected all of these together. And they sent them to an external reviewer. They paid some guy to do an analysis of them in Cork, a professor of general practice in Cork. And he's concluded that he disagrees with me.
But he's entitled to it. Well, here's the thing. He's entitled to disagree with you if he wants to.
Yeah,
that doesn't make him right.
He believes that my opinion undermines the guidelines and undermined general practice. And
but then where are we when we want to
undermine?
But there was an article in the paper there a while ago. I think you sent it to me, actually, in relation to encouraging people within the health service to come forward when they see things wrong. In other words, to whistleblow. So where do we stand when it comes to media, when it comes to questioning things, when it comes to challenging the state?
Do you know who wrote that article? That was an article in the Irish Examiner, and your viewers or people should look at it and listen to after they've listened to this podcast. That was written by Dr. Suzanne Crowe, the president of the Irish Medical Council. And the banner in the article is "Punishing those who speak out punishes us all." I
mean, and that's what exactly what they're doing to you right now. Yeah.
Well, there's not just me. There's about eight of us. I mean, these because of the media blackout that you talked about earlier on, doctors like me have no. We're essentially pariahs, you know. So we don't have much of a voice. But so these hearings. There was a GP, Dr. Neville Wilson. I think he's down in Selbridge, maybe, but or Kilcock. But anyway, he's the most recent case who's been punished. He was dragged to a fitness to practice hearing because he put a poster up in his waiting room saying that he advised his patients that the COVID vaccine was risky or whatever. So he was hauled before a fitness to practice hearing and sanctioned and that. So these hearings are going on in the background. I mean,
if you lose this in June, is that you gone? Is that your license, your years of training, your career? You know, are you going to have to go back to embroidery? I mean, is that it now? Is it for Marcus?
Well, I don't know. It'll depend on the council. I mean, they do not like me because I was on the council, and because I know. I mean, the council collects, the Medical Council of Ireland. There's 20,000 doctors in Ireland. The Medical Council collects about 18 million euros a year in fees from the registered doctors in Ireland. And basically, they sit around every week and have meetings on how to spend that money, you know. Yeah. I mean, there's not a lot goes on at the Medical Council in terms of public safety or public, you know, helping the public. But they're not very, very happy with me for speaking out. And so they are going after me. What the consequences will be, I don't know.
What happens if they do take your license off you? Is there an appeal process, or is that you going to the High Court? Or I mean, how does that work?
Well, when the Medical Council removes somebody's license, that has to be sanctioned by the High Court. So, I mean, if they take away my license, a High Court judge will have to agree with that and just sanction that or rubber stamp that. So I'll have an opportunity to appear in the High Court, you know. But, okay. One thing you have to remember, too, with all of this, Niall, is the 10 of us who have been speaking out or published criticisms of policy or the vaccine, you know, our medical insurance for the majority of us has said that they're not going to cover these cases. And the reason they won't cover these cases is because there's no patient, there's no illness, there's no
nobody's been harmed in the process. Yeah.
Nobody's been harmed. So the Medical Council has an unlimited has a budget. I mean, they have limitless funds, you know. So a lot of the doctors under investigation with the council, you know, in order to be able to still provide for their families.
Well, look, I wish you well in that hearing, and I hope that goes well for you. But let me get back to COVID-19. And here we are, 5 years later. I've lost track of time, to be honest with you. 5 years since it started, obviously. And looking back in hindsight, now there's no inquiry as of yet. They keep kicking the inquiry down the road. And even when there is an inquiry, we heard Leo and Micheál Martin saying it's not going to be a blame game. In other words, no one's going to be accountable for their bad decisions, including those in Neffitt.
Of course not.
Okay, so just looking back, I mean, at one stage you talked about masks as well. It now looks like, with numerous studies have been done in relation to lockdowns, masks, restrictions, so countries who had the least amount of restrictions versus countries who had the most, it made little, and the quote is, it made little or no difference according to most published papers now. So that was a huge mistake. It didn't make any bloody difference whatsoever. This idea of locking people up, telling people they couldn't go more than 6K, you know, you'd have three people in your gaff or whatever it was. Actually, all it did was slow down the whole process and made the damn thing last longer. So when you look back in hindsight, do you think you should have spoke louder? And also, can I say something else to you as well? When I was on the radio, my producers at the time, we would have a lot of professionals on, including yourself. We had other doctors who were specialists, infectious disease specialists, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of them would say to my producer, look, I think this is a load of shite, yada, 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 yada. Not in those words. But look, I can't say that on the air. I lose my job. And you made a quote. You asked that to the colleagues who told me quietly that I was right, but said nothing publicly. I understood then, but silence has cost, has a cost, and I'm paying it now. Do you think Do you think they're even going to bother coming forward? Because there was a few there, outliers. When I say outliers, there was a few there that got basically a lot of work out of RTE promoting it as such, or promoting the restrictions.
I mean, during the pandemic, if you had have published a paper to say that COVID was spread by flies or it was spread by rainbows or was on door handles, you would have got no end of
attraction. Oh, no, I know. Yeah, redheaded people get it more than brown-haired people and all that. Yeah,
but any sort of criticism of government policy was rather viciously policed by the Minister for Health through the Medical Council. I mean, you have to remember the Medical Council is answerable to the Minister, all of the appointees. When I was on the Council, I was appointed by the Minister. Every sitting member of the Council is appointed by the Minister. Now, a few are elected. I was elected onto the Council by my colleagues, but we're all appointed by the Minister, and the Minister can remove Medical Council members, and all of the President has a direct line to the minister as such. So the minister used the Irish Medical Council to suppress. And the minister, of course, was Simon Harris, who shortly after COVID became Taoiseach and is now the tarnished. So,
Stephen Donnelly, of course, had to a lot of it as well. Man, he lost his seat. But, rightly so.
Exactly. But I mean, ultimately, the level of corruption that we're dealing with in Ireland and the suppression of free speech.
But whose fault is that? Is that the media? It is the media, isn't it? I mean, because I had colleagues, and I'm going to say, many of them I wouldn't even speak to now, to be honest with you, after COVID-19, because I had, when I say colleagues, people, acquaintances in radio who did talk shows. I'm not going to start naming names, but some of them, I was disgusted listening to them, the way they spoke about the general public, particularly when it came to the vaccines. You know, this idea of segregating those who didn't and those who did. I mean, I was all for choice at the time, and I said it on there numerous times. It's your choice, and I don't believe in this kind of apartheid situation where you're not allowed to go to a restaurant, or you're not allowed to leave the country, or you're not allowed to do this, that, and the other if you don't have the vaccine, because it was a terrible thing to do. But I heard numerous broadcasters promoting that idea and essentially calling those who didn't get vaccinated murderers. Essentially,
but not when you say media. I mean, the only doctor, the only one of us, really. I mean, there's a good solid number of doctors in Ireland who objected to policies, not all policies, and certainly not the entirety of the vaccine schedule and trying to protect the elderly or that sort of thing. But you know, there were a number of doctors trying to object, but RTE is in the pocket of the government. I mean, RTE is dependent on state funding, so it's essentially a state broadcaster. It's not going to.
But it wasn't just RTE. During COVID, they were all dependent on state funding, weren't they?
They were, yeah. So unfortunately, a lot of things collided or came together at the same time, really, to cause a media blackout. But it's a real kind of a question as to why now. Like, I think the Medical Council feel now that, you know, the COVID is over, people have forgotten, you know, I'm a bit of a has-been, you know, Dr. De Bruin. People aren't too concerned. They're kind of looking at other things and they're not really interested in the 50 billion and the 2,000 dead and the nursing homes. I mean, they give government are getting away with no public inquiry, no compensation scheme for vaccine injured patients, nothing, you know, there's absolutely nothing. I mean, we live in a very, I mean, I wonder sometimes.
But why, I keep wondering why, when you say, you know, RTE are in the pocket of the government, there's no doubt about that, by the way, they got 750 million over 3 years from the state, okay? So there's no doubt they're in the pocket of the government. But, and there was no doubt at the time when you had these stupid programs like Clare Byrne having people going around in inflatable bubbles and having hairdressers drying people's hair through glass cases and all this stupid stuff. And then you had two qualified doctors sitting at sewing machines making masks. I mean, it was actually comical when you look back at it now, how they even thought this was good television. But it was all to promote this idea. And every day in the news, full seven people are dead today, you know. Seven people die every day, you know what I mean? People die all the time, you know. Yeah. It was like bingo at night on RTE. And it went on for the whole... I don't know how long, but it went on for the whole 2 years of it. It was just the top story in the news. Like, there's nothing else happening in the bloody world apart from this. And now when we look back, of course, there's more excess deaths now than there was actually during those 2 year period. It was actually less deaths bizarre. During those 2 years, which is quite bizarre. But here's the thing. So if we're saying all that came together for this kind of blackout, well, that suggests there's a man behind the curtain. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I'm trying to figure out who or why.
Well, I tried to figure that out too. And the only answer I could come up with it is, I mean, why all of a sudden did the Irish Medical Council start working on behalf of a vaccine manufacturer? And why did they stop us from treating
elderly patients? But they weren't the
only
ones. Yeah. Yeah. Every country was doing the same thing.
Stop us? Well, but I don't know. I don't know if every other country was policing doctors and putting them up on trial for using hydroxychloroquine. I mean, that's bizarre. You know,
but they were. I mean, we saw recently Mark Zuckerberg admitting that the American government had asked him to remove tweets from American doctors who went against government policy when it came to COVID-19. And he admitted and regrets doing that now because he was wrong to do it, because obviously it turned out many of those doctors were actually right. So, I mean, it wasn't just in Ireland. It was happening all across the world.
Oh, but does that make it right? I mean, this phenomena of regulatory capture, where regulatory agencies like the Irish Medical Council or the College of General Practice, they were captured essentially by the interests of large conglomerates or corporations. I mean, that's the only explanation that I can come up with for why, you know, these people were, why the general public were denied access to potential treatments, and why there was a level of incompetence in the nursing homes that could only be described as manslaughter. You know, I mean, but we'd only ever get the answer to those questions if the questions could be answered. But RTE won't even ask the questions, and the government won't even have a public inquiry. So that alone is telling.
What was bizarre was poor old Martin Feely, God rest his soul. I mean, Martin, of course, a very qualified doctor, a man of great integrity and credibility. He came out to say, you know, the whole thing was being taken out of context and exaggerated. We needed to calm down. He talked about herd immunity. He talked about all of the sorts of things and the way we've dealt with things for years. And he was brought on to RTE just for a little annihilation. You know, if he had the opposite opinion and agreed with the government, well, then he'd be brought on to RT to be complimented. I mean, it was like they kind of just wanted to embarrass him publicly. And mind you, he did a great job of defending himself. He was cancelled. He was told to resign.
Cancelled after that.
Yeah.
There was no further access. I mean, RTE, I think that somebody in RTE probably got a slap on the wrist for having him on, because he was the only one of us. I mean, Martin was so high profile, and Martin was an absolute gentleman, but he was so high profile in terms that he was head of the Midlands Regency Hospital.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. He was so high profile that they couldn't avoid him. But essentially the rest of us, I mean, there were a number of GPs in Ireland.
Were you ever on RTE?
No.
Never?
No.
I find that incredible.
Very, very. They did contact me at the very, very early stages when I was in the midst of when I resigned from the medical council. Yeah. And I think I said to one of the journalists, if you make a donation to AWARE, to the elderly charity, I might come on. But I was so disgusted with them and with what was happening that I didn't speak to them. But they may have made contact once, but that was it. Now, I'm absolutely convinced that there was a directive at RTE not to interview
anybody who challenged us. Okay, in relation to the vaccine itself, now, I read some of the tweets that you put up in relation to the vaccine itself. What is your feelings now on the vaccine? Now, remembering, of course, that this vaccine is probably the most distributed vaccine in the world, ever been, you know, because everybody was given it. I don't know how many billion shots were given worldwide. And I'm going to be honest, I got the vaccine. And the only reason I got it, and I regret it to this day, the only reason I got it was because I wanted to go on bloody holidays. And I think many people, I remember putting up a tweet there recently asking people why they got the vaccine. Was it one, for health reasons, two, because they wanted to go to a restaurant or a bar, or three, wanted to go on holidays? And the majority of people just answered that they didn't want to be obviously divided from the public or segregated. And that's why they got it. They wanted to go on holidays. They wanted to go to bar and restaurants. They wanted to go to gigs, all those things. So people were kind of forced into making that decision. I mean, we were being compromised. Now, I'm not going to get into a conversation as to whether the vaccine is bad, good, or indifferent. But I mean, as a doctor, do you think the vaccine overall has been beneficial? Or do you think this vaccine in particular, and again, this is not an anti-vax conversation, because I know you have talked to me before about, you know, you've supplied the MMR vaccine to children for years, you know. So, I mean, this particular vaccine, do you think it was a bad idea, a bad move?
Well, I absolutely do think it was a bad move. And I think that you're right. I think most people who took it were coerced into taking it and pressured. My family took it. My, you know, my adult children took it. You know, my wife took it because there was nowhere to go. We were, I mean, people in Ireland, I think we're either a degenerate bunch or we're completely demoralized because, you know, the what was done to us as a people was absolutely heinous in terms of the, you know, there were very few other countries that behaved the way our government behaved in terms of the coercion that went on. I mean, when I left my practice, I maintained a phone or a video practice, and I was speaking to people or offering consultations or whatever online, you know, privately. And you know, I spent the vast majority of my time writing exemption letters for people, for nurses, for student nurses, for teachers, who were all calling me up crying on the phone, crying, saying that they were being forced, compelled, they were going to be fired, you know, if they didn't take the vaccine. What went on was absolutely horrible. And they were. And the sad thing is I think, you know, most Irish people look back at like yourself and they feel guilty that they took it. But it's just so sad. And this is what I mean.
Well, I didn't need, the reason I feel bad is I didn't need it. I don't know. I took a vaccine I didn't actually bloody need.
But my question is why do we look back and feel a little bit guilty? Why isn't that translated into anger at the people that forced us to take this and do these things?
Because things were being said to people.
Why is the anger not even at the level where we have an inquiry?
Well, I mean, look at the coercion they did. This kind of narrative that went out, take the vaccine or you'll kill your granny kind of thing, right? And the point, the whole stupidness of that was, according to the doctors at the time, this vaccine was 100%, it would stop you from getting COVID and stop the spread of COVID, right? It turned out to be a completely false claim, by the way, because it turned out that Pfizer then turned around later after it was all over and said, actually, no, we never actually tested it to see if it would reduce transmissibility, because that was a completely fraudulent and fake claim. So in other words, we were still going to kill Granny anyway. And if Granny was vaccinated according to their claim that it was 100% and she wasn't going to get COVID, why were we killing her in the first place? So the whole thing made little or no sense whatsoever. It turned out in the end, it made little or no difference whether you were vaccinated or not. It seems to me. They then tried to say, okay, well, maybe it won't stop you from getting COVID, but it'll stop you being very sick. And then people were still being very sick after they got vaccinated. Oh, well, maybe it won't stop you getting sick, but it'll stop you being hospitalised. And then people were being hospitalised after being vaccinated. And it was just, oh, it'll stop you going to ICU. And it just got silly at one stage.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that this is, I mean, most people took the vaccine and they weren't informed properly of what was in it and how it works. And certainly when you scratch the surface and you see how it works and what's in it, you know, it operates at a completely different level, as I've said. So there's no doubt in my mind this vaccine. I mean, and at the end of the day, look, the vaccine, again, it's like me. It's old news. It's collapsed. Nobody takes it anymore. Last year, 92% of Irish healthcare workers did not take the COVID vaccine.
Are they still giving out boosters? Boosters?
Well, the reason they're giving it out, the only people who are really taking it are people who are confined in nursing homes and have no bloody choice and are partially demented and can't kind of consent or whatever, and they're just injected. And bizarrely, they've been injected by, you know, 92% of the staff injecting them haven't taken it themselves. You know, I mean, I'm up in front of the medical council, you know, and one of the main reasons is my criticism of this vaccine. And the irony here is that you could be sure the people who have me on trial and I'm going to be on my trial in front of, you can be damn sure they haven't taken it either. And they're trying me for criticizing it.
In relation to the damage from this vaccine. Now, there's no doubt every vaccine carries a risk. Every vaccine, of course, it carries a risk. You know, you can have localized pain. You know, you can possibly get the actual disease that you're vaccinating against. That's with live vaccines, of course. You know, or you can get it. You can be very sick from it. So there's no doubt that people have died over the years from vaccines. That's the risk. You know, the argument is they save more lives than they actually kill, or they actually hurt, or more damage. In relation to this particular vaccine, we've heard of young men having heart attacks. And people try to link that to the vaccine. Do you believe that's linked to the vaccine? We've heard of lots of other things that have been linked to the vaccine. I spoke to one very eminent professor in this country who wouldn't go on the record either. And as soon as the vaccine was released, he sent me a private message saying, wait for the psychotonic storms. That's all he said to me. Because I said to him, do you want to come on the air today and talk about the vaccine? And he says, no, you're all
cytokines.
Right.
Cytokines.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, no. And he said, wait for the cytokine storms. So in other words, they knew there was a risk attached to this vaccine. And yet they still promoted it, even though there was they felt there was some risk attached to it. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't know how many people the vaccine may have saved. I don't know. But I mean, was there a higher risk, in your opinion, with this vaccine than other vaccines?
Yes, this my opinion, I've mentioned how it works in terms of it works completely different to every other type of vaccine. And it works in a way that you're not getting a piece of dead bug or something that you're generating an immune response to. You're not getting a dead virus. You're getting a gene, and the gene goes inside your cells and hijacks your cells and gets your cells to manufacture a spike protein. Now, the reason I believe that this got emergency use and that governments and ministers are in the pocket of the pharmaceutical companies is that this vaccine represents a crossing the Rubicon. If a drug company, if Pfizer, can actually give you a gene and have your body make the drug, your body make the vaccine, your body make the chemical that they want to produce, it's a game changer in terms of production. You don't need factories. You don't need staff. You're actually tricking the human body to manufacture the drug. There's no product control. There's no, because the process is happening inside you and not in a factory somewhere. So this vaccine represents a huge step for the biotechnology industry, a massive step. And that step is lost on the general public. People don't know what's happening in the background. But this type of technology now has essentially opened the gates for the production of a vast number of potential medicines. And maybe some of them will be good, I don't know. But the technology itself is dangerous without a shadow of a doubt. And what they're doing, what they're playing around with human genetics is highly dangerous and should be stopped. And these vaccines should be completely withdrawn. Thankfully,
they have been withdrawn in some countries. Yeah.
Oh, and people have copped on and they're not taking them. But there's absolutely no doubt in my mind these are dangerous products.
Okay, so you believe it was more dangerous than any other vaccine brought out? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, and you know what? When I think back when I got it, you know, and I got it to go on holidays, and my health hasn't been great over the last 5 months. I've been particularly bad, all due to my immune system and my immune response, because what I've got are things that are reasonably easy to cure, I suppose. You know, mononucleosis and Lyme disease. Lyme disease with antibiotics, mononucleosis should go away reasonably easily itself. Mind you, at my age, it's a bit longer, obviously. But
yeah,
my immune system.
It's kind of bizarre, isn't it? Infectious mononucleosis, again, a viral syndrome. Like, you know, these are, you're talking about odd connections here, you know, like, you know, people getting shingles. Again, that's another.
There was a huge increase in shingles, wasn't it? The year after the vaccine. Weird increase.
Weird stuff. And totally, I mean, look, at the end of the day, Niall, people did not get informed consent. They don't know how this worked and what was happening. The manufacturers used the word vaccine and that worked. I mean, even just when you think about it, when you get the vaccine, so you get the gene and that turns on production inside your cells to manufacture the spike protein, but there's no off switch. When you look at the genetic code of what you've been given, there's no off switch. So, and the manufacturer tells us, oh, don't worry, the gene will just break down and it'll degrade. So there's no off switch for the production of spike protein. And any cell, there's no specificity. So any cell in your body can take it up. So what the hell is going on here? You're giving somebody a drug where you can't control the dosage. You can't control the dosage and you can't control where it goes. I mean, this is how they got that over the line was this emergency use authorization. And how they did that was by letting people in the nursing homes and letting people die and letting old people.
Well, they were clever enough, mind you. They let the government take all the financial liability for it if anything went wrong. But okay, so here's the other thing. Just finally, Marcus, we've seen an increase in excess deaths since COVID-19, not during COVID-19, ironically enough. And some people would argue some of that's due to the vaccine. Maybe some of it is. I don't know. But there's also the argument as well that the reason that is, and there was a published paper, I think, in Philadelphia somewhere. I'm not going to quote it directly because I can't remember. But they did say something like 75 million people will die in the next 20 or 30 years because of COVID-19 restrictions and lockdowns. Maybe it wasn't quite that figure, but it was somewhere around that. And it was due to the fact that people didn't get early diagnosis. They couldn't get to see you, obviously, or other GPs because it was difficult to get an appointment. Then there were all Zoom appointments, yeah, etc. So people didn't get early diagnosis. They couldn't go to hospital. The hospital appointments were cancelled. They changed their lifestyles, maybe start drinking, maybe start eating more. So they got, you know, diabetes or whatever. So all of those things affect people long term. In other words, people won't live as long as they should have lived because of those 2 years. Do you think that did a huge damage health-wise to society?
Oh, I think so. And in so many ways, you know, I think, you know, when you, like, I became a GP because I enjoy the doctor-patient relationship. And you know, I have a relationship with my patients that many GPs enjoy. And my patients, to me, are my equals. They're my, in many respects, they become my friends. And we establish a kind of a rapport together where we work together to try and find a way out of the problem that they might be going through. When you sever and you take and I suppose, you know, people, I'm not the patient's friend, I'm their physician, and they know that I have an experience and a qualification and a degree of expertise so that I can hopefully guide them to a better place. When you take away the doctor-patient relationship, you know, and when you take away the hope that a doctor can actually treat you or give you something, which is what went on during COVID, shutting down the health service, telling doctors to do nothing, you know, when you take hope and you take that relationship away, you do something very, very dangerous to a society, and you do something very, very dangerous to ill people and to vulnerable people. But there's no doubt in my mind that we will experience, our children, I think my children and most children in Ireland will experience the consequences of being pulled out of school and the shutdown of the education system. But, you know, on a brutal practical level, I mean, I had a patient of mine who came to me for bowel screening, for a colonoscopy, needed a colonoscopy as such because he had symptoms. And, you know, and I sent him for his colonoscopy, and that was delayed 6-8 months, and I don't know how much longer, because then there was a backlog when the system kicked back on again. But when I got his results back, you know, he had extensive bowel cancer, had spread, you know. He's not unique, you know, and you know, that man had to get chemotherapy, radiotherapy, had to get a bag, you know. His experience is
that could have been avoided, is what you're saying. Yeah,
not unique. And not only could it have been avoided, but the questions need to be asked. These people need a voice. People injured by the vaccine need a voice. You know, people injured by lockdowns, you know, should be heard. You know, as I said, I don't understand.
There was this whole idea that the hospitals were going to be out of control, and the hospitals weren't. They weren't anywhere close to it. It was one or two times there were a little bit of pressure.
They were doing dancing videos. They were dancing up and down the corridors.
With the guards.
And doing river dancing.
Yeah, what was that called? What was that? Jerusalem. Jerusalem, wasn't that what they called it? Yeah, yeah. I found that actually embarrassing. You know what I mean?
And they must feel like gobshites now.
Anyway, look, Marcus, I wish you well in June, and I'm sure we'll hear from you before then and after then. I wish you well. I hope you don't lose your license, because you're a good guy, and I know you care about your patients. And the only reason you're doing this, yeah, and you're talking about it again, because I know you kind of, by the way, what, you were kind of AWOL there for a few years. You kind of went a bit quiet. I suppose you're trying to gather your thoughts, were you?
Well, no, I went through a depression as a consequence. You know, it's a very lonely place to be.
Oh yeah,
when a lot of your,
I had that feeling during in the media. You get that same feeling when I hear some of my colleagues. Well, I felt they were my colleagues at the time.
Yeah,
you know, all saying I'm playing the government tune, and there was me questioning things. Now, I wasn't anti-government. I was just questioning things. I wanted to question things. I wanted to bring people on who questioned it and not just have people on who agreed all the time. You know, but unfortunately, as you rightly pointed out, the media, to some degree, independent and otherwise, was compromised because they had no advertising. I don't blame them for taking money, by the way, from the Broadcasting Authority. They had no money. They could, all their advertising revenue was gone. Nightclubs, cinemas, holiday companies, everything was closed. So they had no revenue. So they had no choice but to take the money from the government. Otherwise, they wouldn't have survived. They'd be gone. But I felt that money should have been given to them without question. That money should have been just given with no conditions. You know, and the only advertising that most radio stations had was, you know, here's another ad for phase 3. You can only go 5 kilometers from your house or whatever. Or here's another advertisement for go out and get the vaccine. Or they were the only ads that they ran, which were being paid for by the state, by the way. But they had no choice. They had to do it. you know?
Yeah. Well, we lost the media and we lost the regulator, as I say. The irony, I suppose, one of the ironies that I find it difficult to stomach is the fact that they initiated an investigation on me, saying I didn't wash my hands at a public rally. But, you know, we sent in doctors and colleagues and patients sent in complaints to the regulator about NPHET, about decisions that were happening, and about people who were dying. So we're writing complaints to the regulator about death, about people, huge amount of suffering, about missed cancers, about, you know, all. I mean, you remember Leo Varadkar rejoined the medical register. So he was the subject of the medical council. But every single complaint that I wrote, that my patients wrote, that other colleagues wrote about death and dying, about horrific things happening as a consequence of lockdown and policy, all those complaints were completely and utterly ignored. None of them investigated.
Well, I'm sorry it led you to the point of depression. I'm really sorry to hear that, Marcus, that you went through that, because it was a tough time. It was a tough time for a lot of people who wanted to just stand up and say, oh, hold on for a second. You know, this is not quite right. You know, I'm all for this and I'm all for this, but this here is a bit silly. You know, and a lot of people were saying that at the time, but immediately they were cancelled or shut down or whatever it was. And I'm sorry it led you to a point where you felt you had to back off because your own mental health was suffering.
We're still here, though. We made it out the other side. Thankfully, I did what Voltaire says. I tended my garden. I got a beehive, and I looked into getting a bit of honey and that sort of thing. So, you know, I got through it. And
Was it worth it?
Well, look, I don't know. It remains to be seen. It was lovely to see the public rally and people out on the streets complaining. You know, I think change will only happen in Ireland when we see some sort of mass movement, because the people responsible for a lot of the corruption are in politics, and they're just getting more powerful and more wealthy and more immune.
Less accountability.
So, you know, I don't know if it was worth it. You know, maybe ask me that in 5 years' time.
I'll ask you that in June. I'll ask you in June when you come out of that meeting. That's probably the best time to ask you. Marcus, it's been lovely talking to you, and I really wish you well. I wish you well in June, by the way, and I'll talk to you again maybe before that and after that when we get the result of that. And I hope that you continue to be a GP for the rest of your life, because I know it's something that you love doing. Marcus de Bruin, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me, Noel.